Chapter 2. It was a quiet night in the shovel. At the bar, which ranged along one side of the large chink log room, leaned half a dozen men, two of whom were discussing the relative merits of spruce tea and lime juice as remedies for scurvy. They argued with an air of depression, and with intervals of morose silence. The other men scarcely heeded them. In a row, against the opposite wall, were the gambling games. The crap table was deserted. One lone man was playing at the faro table. The roulette ball was not even spinning, and the gamekeeper stood by the roaring, red-hot stove, talking with the young, dark-eyed woman, comely of face and figure, who was known from Juneau to Fort Yukon as the Virgin. Three men sat in at stud poker, but they played with small chips and without enthusiasm, while there were no onlookers. On the floor of the dancing room, which opened out at the rear, three couples were waltzing drearily to the strains of a violin and a piano. Circle City was not deserted, nor was money tight. The miners were in from Moseyed Creek, and the other diggings to the west. The summer washing had been good, and the men's pouches were heavy with dust and nuggets. The Klondike had not yet been discovered, nor had the miners of the Yukon learned the possibilities of deep digging and wood firing. No work was done in the winter, and they made a practice of hibernating in the large camps like Circle City during the long Arctic night. Time was heavy on their hands, their pouches were well filled, and the only social diversion to be found was in the saloons. Yet the shovel was practically deserted, and the Virgin, standing by the stove, yawned with uncovered mouth and said to Charlie Bates, "If something don't happen soon, I'm gin to bed. What's the matter with the camp, anyway? Everybody dead?" Bates did not even trouble to reply, but went on moodily rolling a cigarette. Dan McDonald, pioneer saloonman and gambler on the Upper Yukon, owner and proprietor of the Tivoli and all its games, wandered forlornly across the great vacant space of floor and joined the two at the stove. "Anybody dead?" the Virgin asked him. "Looks like it," was the answer. "Then it must be the whole camp," she said with an air of finality, and with another yawn. McDonald grinned and nodded, and opened his mouth to speak, when the front door swung wide, and a man appeared in the light. A rush of frost, turned to vapor by the heat of the room, swirled about him to his knees, and poured on across the floor, growing thinner and thinner, and perishing a dozen feet from the stove. Taking the whisk broom from its nail inside the door, the newcomer brushed the snow from his moccasins and high German socks. He would have appeared a large man had not a huge French Canadian stepped up to him from the bar and gripped his hand. "Hello, daylight," was his greeting. "Why gar, you good for sore eyes. Hello, Louis, when did you all blow in?" returned the newcomer. "Come up and have a drink, and tell us all about Bone Creek. Why, doggone you all, shake again. Where's that partner of yours? I'm looking for him." Another huge man detached himself from the bar to shake hands. Olive Henderson and French Louis, partners together on Bone Creek, were the two largest men in the country, and though they were but half a head taller than the newcomer, between them he was dwarfed completely. "Hello, Olive, you're my meat, savvy that," said the one called Daylight. "Oh, morrow's my birthday, and I'm going to put you all on your back, savvy? And you too, Louis. I can put you all on your back on my birthday, savvy? Come up and drink, Olive, and I'll tell you all about it." The arrival of the newcomer seemed to send a flood of warmth through the place. "Tea's burning, Daylight," the Virgin cried, the first to recognize him as he came into the light. Charlie Bates' tight features relaxed at the sight, and McDonald went over and joined the three at the bar. With the advent of burning daylight, the whole place became suddenly brighter and cheerier. The barkeepers were active. Voices were raised. Somebody laughed. And when the fiddler, peering into the front room, remarked to the pianist, "It's burning daylight," the waltz time perceptibly quickened, and the dancers, catching the contagion, began to whirl about, as if they really enjoyed it. It was known to them of old time that nothing languished when burning daylight was around. He turned from the bar and saw the woman by the stove, and the eager look of welcome she extended him. "Hello, virgin, old girl," he called. "Hello, Charlie. What's the matter with you all? Why wear faces like that, when coffins cost only 3 ounces? Come up, you all, and drink. Come up, you unburied dead, and name your poison. Come up, everybody. This is my night, and I'm going to ride it. Tomorrow I'm 30, and then I'll be an old man. It's the last fling of youth. Are you all with me? Surge along, then. Surge along. Hold on there, Davis," he called to the faro dealer, who had shoved his chair back from the table. "I'm going you one flutter to see whether you all drink with me, or we all drink with you." Pulling a heavy sack of gold dust from his coat pocket, he dropped it on the high card. 50, he said. The faro dealer slipped 2 cards. The high card won. He scribbled the amount on a pad, and the weigher at the bar balanced $50 worth of dust in the gold scales, and poured it into Burning Daylight's sack. The waltz in the back room being finished, the 3 couples, followed by the fiddler and the pianist and heading for the bar, caught Daylight's eye. "Surge along, you all," he cried. "Urge along and name it. This is my night, and it ain't a night that comes frequent. Surge up, you siwashes and salmon eaters. It's my night, I tell you all, a blame mangy night," Charlie Bates interpolated. "You're right, my son," Burning Daylight went on gaily. "A mangy night, but it's my night, you see. I'm the mangy old he-wolf. Listen to me howl." And howl he did, like a lone gray timber wolf, till the virgin thrust her pretty fingers in her ears and shivered. A minute later she was whirled away in his arms to the dancing floor, where, along with the other 3 women and their partners, a rollicking Virginia reel was soon in progress. Men and women danced in moccasins, and the place was soon aroar, Burning Daylight the center of it, and the animating spark, with quip and jest and rough merriment rousing them out of the slough of despond in which he had found them. The atmosphere of the place changed with his coming. He seemed to fill it with his tremendous vitality. Men who entered from the street felt it immediately, and in response to their queries the barkeepers nodded at the back room, and said comprehensively, "Burning Daylight's on the tier." And the men who entered remained, and kept the barkeepers busy. The gamblers took heart of life, and soon the tables were filled, the click of chips and whir of the roulette ball rising monotonously and imperiously above the hoarse rumble of men's voices, and their oaths and heavy laughs. Few men knew Elam Harnish by any other name than Burning Daylight, the name which had been given him in the early days in the land, because of his habit of routing his comrades out of their blankets with the complaint that daylight was burning. Of the pioneers in that far Arctic wilderness, where all men were pioneers, he was reckoned among the oldest. Men like Al Mayo and Jack McQuestion antedated him, but they had entered the land by crossing the Rockies from the Hudson Bay country to the east. He, however, had been the pioneer over the Chilkoot and Chilkat passes. In the spring of 1883, 12 years before, a stripling of 18, he had crossed over the Chilkoot with 5 comrades. In the fall he had crossed back with 1. 4 had perished by mischance in the bleak, uncharted vastness. And for 12 years Elam Harnish had continued to grope for gold among the shadows of the circle. And no man had groped so obstinately nor so enduringly. He had grown up with the land. He knew no other land. Civilization was a dream of some previous life. Camps like 40 Mile and Circle City were to him metropolises. And not alone had he grown up with the land, for, raw as it was, he had helped to make it. He had made history and geography, and those that followed wrote of his traverses, and charted the trails his feet had broken. Heroes are seldom given to hero worship, but among those of that young land, young as he was accounted an elder hero. In point of time he was before them. In point of deed he was beyond them. in point of endurance it was acknowledged that he could kill the hardiest of them. Furthermore, he was accounted a nervy man, a square man, and a white man. In all lands where life is a hazard lightly played with and lightly flung aside, men turn, almost automatically, to gambling for diversion and relaxation. In the Yukon, men gambled their lives for gold, and those that won gold from the ground gambled for it with one another. Nor was Elam Harnish an exception. He was a man's man primarily, and the instinct in him to play the game of life was strong. Environment had determined what form that game should take. He was born on an Iowa farm, and his father had emigrated to eastern Oregon, in which mining country Elam's boyhood was lived. He had known nothing but hard knocks for big stakes. Pluck and endurance counted in the game, but the great god chance dealt the cards. Honest work for sure, but meager returns did not count. A man played big. He risked everything for everything, and anything less than everything meant that he was a loser. So for 12 Yukon years, Elam Harnish had been a loser. True, on Moosehide Creek the past summer he had taken out $20,000, and what was left in the ground was $20,000 more. But, as he himself proclaimed, that was no more than getting his ante back. He had anteed his life for a dozen years, and 40,000, and was a small pot for such a stake the price of a drink, and a dance at the Tivoli, of a winter's flutter at Circle City, and a grubstake for the year to come. The men of the Yukon reversed the old maxim till it read, "Hard come, easy go." At the end of the reel, Elam Harnish called the house up to drink again. Drinks were $1 apiece, gold rated at $16 an ounce. There were 30 in the house that accepted his invitation, and between every dance the house was Elam's guest. This was his night, and nobody was to be allowed to pay for anything. Not that Elam Harnish was a drinking man. Whiskey meant little to him. He was too vital and robust, too untroubled in mind and body, too inclined to the slavery of alcohol. He spent months at a time on trail and river, when he drank nothing stronger than coffee, while he had gone a year at a time without even coffee. But he was gregarious, and since the sole social expression of the Yukon was the saloon, he expressed himself that way. When he was a lad in the mining camps of the West, men had always done that. To him it was the proper way for a man to express himself socially. He knew no other way. He was a striking figure of a man, despite his garb, being similar to that of all the men in the Tivoli. Soft tanned moccasins of moose hide, beaded in Indian designs, covered his feet. His trousers were ordinary overalls, his coat was made from a blanket. Long gauntleted leather mittens, lined with wool, hung by his side. They were connected in the Yukon fashion, by a leather thong passed around the neck and across the shoulders. On his head was a fur cap, the ear flaps raised and the tying cords dangling. His face, lean and slightly long, with the suggestion of hollows under the cheekbones, seemed almost Indian. The burnt skin and keen dark eyes contributed to this effect, though the bronze of the skin and the eyes themselves were essentially those of a white man. He looked older than 30, and yet, smooth-shaven and without wrinkles, he was almost boyish. This impression of age was based on no tangible evidence. It came from the abstracter facts of the man, from what he had endured and survived, which was far beyond that of ordinary men. He had lived life naked and tensely, and something of all this smoldered in his eyes, vibrated in his voice, and seemed forever a whisper on his lips. The lips themselves were thin, and prone to close tightly over the even, white teeth. But their harshness was retrieved by the upward curl at the corners of his mouth. This curl gave to him sweetness, as the minute puckers at the corners of the eyes gave him laughter. These necessary graces saved him from a nature that was essentially savage, and that otherwise would have been cruel and bitter. The nose was lean, full-nostrilled, and delicate, and of a size to fit the face, while the high forehead, as if to atone for its narrowness, was splendidly domed and symmetrical. In line with the Indian effect was his hair, very straight and very black, with a gloss to it that only health could give. Burning daylight's burning candlelight, laughed Dan McDonald, as an outburst of exclamations and merriment came from the dancers. And he is der boy to do it, eh, Louis? Said Olive Henderson. Yes, by gar, you bet on that, said French Louis. At boy is all gold, and when God Almighty washes daylight's soul out on the last big sluicin' day, McDonald interrupted, why, God Almighty'll have to shovel gravel along with him into the sluice boxes. Dot is good, Olive Henderson muttered, regarding the gambler with profound admiration. Ver good, affirmed French Louis. Think we take a drink on that one time, eh? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.